Okay, so let me introduce today's speaker. It's Bob Bilby. He's conducted research on stream ecosystems, salmon, and the effects of forestry since 1975. And he's the chief environmental scientist for Weyerhaeuser Company and responsible for coordinating environmental research efforts on all company forest lands. Prior to his current position, he managed the Environmental Forestry Research Program and Weyerhaeuser's Western Forestry Research Program. But he did, for 2 years, from 1998 through 2000, he managed the Watershed Processes Program at the National Marine Fisheries Service over here in Montlake, in Seattle. So he's an affiliate faculty member at the University of Washington School for Forest Services here, and also in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Science. And his research has included investigation of the role of large water streams, response of stream trophic systems to disturbances, relationship between habitat characteristics and salmon production, and the contribution that spawning salmon make to nutrient capital and productivity of streams, particularly the contribution that salmon make after they return from the ocean. He received a Bachelor of Science in Zoology from the University of Rhode Island and a PhD in Aquatic Ecology from Cornell University. And today he's going to tell us about the effects of development on coho salmon and implications for stream habitat restoration. Bob.
Thanks, Bob. I probably should have provided you with a shorter introduction. Good morning. Today I'm going to talk about some work that I did actually a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, in conjunction with Lauren Villarin. At the time, Lauren was a graduate student here, and her name was Malott, not Villarin. But what we decided to do was take a look at the relationship between coho salmon abundance and patterns of land use in central Puget Sound. I'm sure those of you who've had some experience with the science around salmon and habitat would think, well, that's pretty obvious. People know that when an area gets developed, when an area gets logged, there's a decline in salmon populations. The fact of the matter is there's relatively little good quantitative evidence of fish response to change in habitat or land use patterns within a watershed. There's plenty of evidence that shows that there's a degradation in habitat conditions associated with human land use, but relatively little information about impacts on fish populations. Now, part of the reason for that has to do with the great degree of interannual, year-to-year variation in salmon populations. And this trace here is simply the number of coho salmon returning to four large central Puget Sound watersheds over a period of about 15 years. And you can see year to year, there's a lot of difference in the number of fish coming back. That can't all be attributed to changes in freshwater habitat condition. Freshwater habitat condition doesn't change that rapidly year to year. Rather, what drives these large variations between years in numbers of returning salmon is marine conditions to a large extent. Marine conditions change, can change very rapidly, and have a huge impact on the survival of fish once they move to the marine environment. Now, other problems in doing this kind of analysis, fish response to changes in habitat condition, one of the bigger problems is the fact that we don't have very good data on fish populations in the Northwest. You might think that we should, given how important salmon are, how much attention they receive, but in fact, there's relatively little long-term data that's been collected consistently at enough sites for us to actually look at relationships between changes over time in habitat condition and changes over time in fish populations. Ideal kinds of data to do that kind of analysis would be annual records on juvenile abundance, how many small fish are living in the stream year to year. Smolt abundance, how many fish leave freshwater to go to the ocean on an annual basis. That kind of data is available, but for relatively few sites across the state. The only source of consistently collected salmon data that we have in Washington State, most locations, is typically numbers of adult salmon returning to spawn. This is particularly good in the Puget Sound region. It's collected by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. It has been for many years. So what we decided to do is to take a look at whether or not we could see differences in adult salmon abundance over time as land use patterns changed. And we looked at salmon populations at sites in four large watersheds, Lake Washington to the south through to the Skagit in the north. We picked these watersheds because the spawning count data here was particularly good. So we went through the WDFW records for a period of time from 1984 to 2001. And we cut it off at 2001 because after 2001, because of budget cuts, WDFW, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, dropped a lot of the sites out of their database. We looked for sites where there was data for each year from 84 to 2001 and where there had been at least three surveys. They'd gone out to that site at least three times each year and counted the number of fish in that stream reach. These are called index reaches. With those criteria, we found 15 sites in the Skagit, 18 in the Stillaguamish, 40 in the Snohomish Basin, and then 11 in Lake Washington Basin, where we had consistent data, total of 84 sites. These are small streams. They're draining relatively small watersheds, ranging in size from 10 hectares to 2,400 hectares. So your ability to see and count coho salmon in these streams at spawning is quite good. So the records are relatively accurate. We associated changes in salmon, and I'll talk in a minute about how we actually characterize salmon abundance, but we looked at changes over that time period from 84 to 2001 in salmon distribution across those 84 sites as it related to changes in land use that occurred within the watersheds above those sites. These four watersheds during that period of time were a terrifically good place to do this kind of analysis because there were lots of changes in land use. I'll show you some data in a minute. But just a thumbnail sketch, the headwaters of all of these major basins still are primarily in forested conditions. Some of it's forest service, some of it's protected areas. Quite a bit of it is still in commercial forest land where logging goes on. But even today, or over the period of time we did this analysis, some of that forest land was disappearing and being converted to rural residential development, houses, hobby farms, things of that sort. If you move downstream in these basins, closer to Puget Sound, human land use activities become much, much more intensive. We have transportation infrastructure. During the period of time from 84 to 2001, very rapid expansion in high-density residential development, industrial development, and along most of the major river corridors in those four basins, agriculture is a very prominent land use. So it's a good place to do this kind of analysis. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we analyze the fish data, and I'll try not to get too dense with this, but it's important to understand what we did here because we looked at the fish data in a fundamentally different way than most people have looked at it in the past. As I said, we were looking at changes not in abundance of fish over time, but changes in the way those fish were distributed across those 84 index sites for which we had data. So the first thing we did is we took the spawner survey counts for each site for each year and calculated an index of how many fish actually returned and utilized that site in a given year. The way that's done is using a method called area under the curve. But basically, if you go out on day five of your survey period, you see no fish, you go out on day 10, you see a couple of fish, then you continue these surveys through the entire period of salmon spawning, you can develop a curve like this of time in days versus number of fish. The area under that curve then gives you an index expressed as fish days of how many total fish actually utilized that site during that spawning season. So this was done for each of those 84 sites for each year of record. We then divided through by the length of the index reach, so we got a metric or a value of fish days per kilometer of stream length for each of the 84 sites. We then took a look at exploitation rates, how many fish were actually caught from those sites in each year for which we had the record. Now, we did this because we thought there may have been differential catch rates from the fish from those sites, which would have obscured any patterns that might be associated with changes in freshwater habitat condition. Well, it turns out, and we used a database called Coded Wire Tags, which is a database that's been collected for many years. Fish as they leave freshwater, mostly hatchery fish, have a small piece of wire with a code on it inserted into their nose. And historically, their adipose fin was then clipped off so people could tell which one were tagged when they came back. But this gave an indication of how many fish from a particular population were being caught in a given year. You take a look at the basins for which we had index site data, the Skagit south to Lake Washington. Turns out that the exploitation rate or the harvest rate on those fish stocks over the time period for which we conducted this analysis were relatively comparable. During the 80s and early 90s, catch rates were quite high, in some cases 90% more or more on some of these stocks. 90% of the fish were being harvested. Then with more stringent controls on harvest management starting in the mid-1990s, those harvest rates on all those stocks dropped considerably, and now they range anywhere from 15 to 25% in a given year. We applied these harvest rates back to our fish day estimates for each of the 84 sites, and basically what we generated then was a fish day count, index of the number of fish that would have used each of those 84 sites in the absence of any harvest on those stocks. So in that way, we've accounted for any differential impact harvest would have had on the number of returning fish. We then expressed those values, those fish day values, as proportions. That is to say, we took a look at what was the total number of fish using all those 84 sites in a given year, and then calculated what percent of that population used each of those 84 sites. It was that proportional value that we looked at when we attempted to look for trends through time and relate those trends to changes in land use. And let me just give you an example of why we did this. Again, what we were trying to do was to tease out the effect that freshwater habitat condition was having on fish, on adult fish returning to these sites to spawn. Now, in order to do that, ideally you would want to remove any effects associated with changes in marine conditions from year to year. We feel that by using proportions, essentially by taking a look at how the fish are distributed among those 84 sites, it gives us some ability to tease out the effects of marine environment. So here's an example. Site 1, 2, and 3, three spawner index sites. Let's say during a period of high marine survival, you might get 5,000 returning to site 1, 10,000 fish to site 2, 5,000 to site 3. On a proportional basis, in terms of how those fish are distributed across those three sites, that's 50% at 2 and 25% at 1 and 3. If we get into a situation where marine conditions are very, very poor and lots of the fish can't survive when they move to the ocean, we might get 50, 150 fish returning. But the distribution of those fish across those three sites is the same, 25%, 50%, 25%, okay? So we felt that by looking at these fish populations as a distribution across the 84 sites, it gave us some ability to eliminate or at least minimize changes in abundance that are associated with changes in marine habitat condition. Okay, I'm sure that's clear as mud, but it may become clearer as we go through some of the results. The other piece of this analysis was taking a look at how land use changed over our study period. Now, we used Landsat imagery to take a look at removal of forest cover between the mid-1980s and 2001. The first clear, comprehensive Landsat image that we could obtain for these four basins was the 1986 coverage. We compared that with the 2001 coverage. So in this set of images, you'll notice this is Swamp Creek, 1986. These yellow and brownish or almost to red colors represent areas of forest. See this area here just below the airport in 1986 was primarily forested. By 2001, it had gone to development. Blues and greens in these photos represent development. Now, when we found an area in the Landsat images where forest had been removed, we assumed that the land use change was represented by what the zoning was for that particular location. In this case, the example I just showed you, that area was zoned for high-density residential development. So we assumed that loss of forest cover in this particular location represented high-density residential development. If we were in a situation where it was zoned for forest land use, loss of forest cover would have been interpreted as logging. Now, once we got through with the analysis using the Landsat and the zoning layers, we went back and used aerial photos and looked at about 10% of our total sample. And we found out that this technique of assigning land use change was actually quite accurate. We correctly identified land use changes 94% of the time. And the primary error occurred in areas where zoning was for rural residential use, that is, housing development on lot sizes of 2 hectares or greater. In some cases, forest cover loss in areas that are designated for rural residential development actually were logging. But that was really the only primary error we got in the land use change analysis. We then took these land use change analysis and took the land use changes and categorized them into 5 categories. We had sites where we had an increase in urban land use. We had watersheds where we had an increase in agricultural land use, although very few. Increased rural residential use, and then we had 2 forest classes, areas where a site stayed as forest but where logging occurred, and areas where a site stayed as forest and no logging occurred over the period of data analysis. And using that system, we actually wound up classifying some of our watersheds in more than one land use change class. There were, for instance, quite a number of watersheds above these index sites where we had both logging and conversion from forest to rural residential land use occurring. In that case, they got assigned to two classes. But we wound up with 12 sites where we had 12 of the 84 where there was increased urban land use, 5 sites where there was increased agricultural land use, although the amount of increase in agricultural land in those 5 watersheds was quite small. There wasn't much conversion of forest land to agriculture over that time period. Lots of rural residential development. And then in forest sites, 22 of them experienced logging between 84 and 2001, and 12 didn't. Okay, let's take a look at how land use changed over this time period. As I said, there was a relatively small increase in agricultural land use. The 84 index sites, relatively small proportion, were in agricultural land anyway, and it was only about a 15% increase in total acreage in agriculture between 86 and 2001. Big increase in urban and industrial, about a 45% increase, 66% increase in rural residential development in the watersheds above those 84 sites, and all of that came at the expense of forest land. In those 84 watersheds, there was a decrease of 16% in forest land between 1986 and 2001. What did the fish do? Well, what we saw was that there was a very dramatic response in terms of how the fish were distributed among those sites. In the urban sites, which is really the big story, in the mid-1980s, those 12 urban sites were responsible for supporting, on average, about 20 or 25% of the total spawning aggregation in a given year. By 2001-2000, those same 12 sites were responsible for supporting about 4 or 5% of the total spawning aggregation, about a 75% decline in the proportion of the spawning population that was supported by those sites that had undergone an increase in agricultural land use. The p-value here represents the value from it's a Mann-Kendall trend test, a non-parametric trend test, which I've applied to all of these. We saw a very slightly significant, less than 0.05, negative trend at the agricultural sites. I don't put much faith in this result because we got so little increase in agricultural land use. Because, though, that these are proportions, any decline in this categorization has to be offset by an increase. And we saw increase in the proportion of salmon supported by rural residential sites and a very strong increase in the proportion of salmon supported at the forested sites. Again, this doesn't necessarily mean there were more salmon going to the forested sites. Because of the big decline at the urban sites, that had to be offset. Every year, it all adds up to 100%. And that occurred at the forested sites. Now, the other comparison here that I'm going to make very quickly, and then I won't talk about it again, is the comparison between sites where forested sites where logging occurred and forested sites where there was no logging. Now, at the sites where there was no logging, there were 12 sites in that classification. There was no trend through time. There was a strong positive trend at the sites where logging occurred, 22 sites. So logging's good for salmon, right? No, that's not, I don't think that's what this data is suggesting. These sites, whether they were logged or whether no logging occurred during that period of time from 84 to 2001, they all are sites where logging has occurred in the past. Road systems are in place in all of these watersheds. Previous logging in many cases has removed riparian vegetation. So a lot of the impacts that we know about related to logging effects on stream habitat apply equally across all of these sites. So I don't think that the fact that logging occurred sometime during our analysis period really had any fundamental effect on the habitat quality in these sites. The other thing to notice is the number of fish supported by these sites. These forested sites with no logging supported relatively few fish. Again, that's not a reflection of the land management at those sites. That's more a reflection of the fact that those are largely Forest Service sites. And after about 1990, very little logging occurred on Forest Service land in the Puget Sound region. But they tend to be at high elevation. They tend to be sites that don't have very good habitat, natural habitat condition for coho salmon. So they just don't support very many fish to begin with. These other sites are primarily and privately owned forest land, lower in the watershed, better habitat characteristics for coho salmon, and you can see they supported far greater proportion of the spawning population. That's probably another reason why we saw a response at those sites and not at the non-log sites. And I'm not going to talk about logging anymore because I don't think it's really a big part of this story. Okay, so the The main finding here was that we saw a very dramatic decline in the proportion of spawning fish supported at sites that had undergone some level of urbanization. That's not a new result. There's been plenty of information previously that's shown that coho salmon in particular are sensitive to urbanization. These are some data that Gene Lucchetti and Bob Furstenberg put together back in the early 1990s, where they looked at a series of streams across King County and related the proportion of the fish community that was composed of coho salmon to the level of impervious surface, essentially the level of development within a watershed. And they found that above about 10% impervious surface in a watershed, coho salmon became decreasingly rarer in the fish community. They just essentially disappeared as development increased. Now, why is urbanization so bad for salmon? Well, there's a variety of reasons. I'll run through these pretty quickly, and many of you are probably familiar with them. But streams in urban environments historically were viewed as the way to get water off the landscape and out into Puget Sound or Lake Washington as quickly as possible. Conveyance of water off the landscape so people didn't get their feet wet was considered to be the primary use, the primary value of stream systems. And over time, obviously, our perception of streams has changed considerably, but a lot of the effects that were associated with that initial view of stream system function are still evident on the landscape in urban environments. Basic physical changes, removal of riparian vegetation, replacement of some of that with exotic species, straightening of stream channels, removal of obstructions like large wood from stream channels all have effects on habitat quality for fish. One of the most studied aspects of urban streams is probably hydrology, especially peak flows, that is, high flows that occur after a rainstorm. Also, in urban streams, they tend to have less low flow. That is, during summer, dry periods, they tend to be lower flow, and those low flows tend to last for a longer period of time because you've altered the ability of that watershed to store water and then release it slowly to the channels. But the flood events in particular are quite striking. Some analyses that were done here in King County a number of years ago estimated that a flood that would be expected to occur about once every 5 years in a forested environment would be expected to occur about on an annual basis in an urbanized stream because of the impervious surfaces, the pavement, the roofs, allows that water to run off very rapidly, move into the stream channel very, very quickly, and as a result, you get a lot of water there in a very short period of time, and it generates a high peak flow. The effects of these more frequent high flows, a variety of them, but certainly increased erosion, increased sediment movement. If you're talking about salmon who have their eggs in the gravel during the wintertime, there's a higher potential for mortality as a result of scour the eggs out of the gravel or burial of the eggs by transported sediment. There's a whole variety of issues associated with altered hydrology that's not necessarily good for aquatic systems. And in urban environments, we typically have chemical contamination as well. Industrial discharges are something that's been studied for the last 40 years. But there also are not what are called non-point sources of pollution that enter stream systems in urban environments. Runoff from yards, runoff from sports fields, golf courses, introduce pesticides. They introduce chemicals like fertilizers, which increase nutrients in stream systems. And with increased nutrients, you can get situations where you have excess algae growth. When that algae dies and begins to decompose, it can actually cause oxygen depletion problems in systems where you don't have a lot of surface turbulence and rapid reaeration. Biological effects associated with these changes, and there's a whole variety of them, and I'm not going to go through them in any detail, but certainly there is ample evidence, a lot of it generated by Jim Carr and his students here at the University of Washington, that benthic invertebrate populations and benthic algae populations in streams in urban environments are less diverse, and in many cases, lower productivity than benthic populations in less disturbed systems. In terms of impacts on fish, in extreme cases, we see direct mortality. Actually, direct mortality on coho salmon occurs quite frequently. I'll talk about that in a second. But the changes due to urbanization lead to altered prey base. It's less for the fish to eat. That kind of food is different. It can affect their growth rates. And there's been quite a bit of work done over the last several years on very low concentrations of pesticides and the effect they have on salmon behavior. And it's been recognized now that a certain class of pesticides, insecticides primarily, have the ability to screw up the olfactory system of fish. And because the sense of smell is important in detecting predators in salmon, because the sense of smell is critically important for adult fish to find their way back to their spawning grounds, this decrease in their sense of smell can have a fairly important impact, negative impact, on the ability of the fish to operate in these systems that have been impacted by urban development. Here's one particularly interesting case that was observed probably about 10 years ago now, but it was observed here in streams in the Seattle area. And some folks noticed that there were a lot of dead coho salmon in streams in Seattle, and they had died before they had actually spawned, like this female coho salmon here, which still has all her eggs intact. So there was a fairly large research effort that was mounted at that time, led by the National Marine Fisheries Service Lab over on Montlake, but also it was participated in by a variety of other organizations to try and figure out what was going on. And they initially thought possibly a disease, but there was no evidence of any disease whatsoever in these fish that were dying. And ultimately, they noticed that there was a correlation between rate of mortality of these adult fish and the amount of roads and highways within a watershed. And subsequently, they discovered that it looks likely that it's copper coming from brake linings that's causing this high rate of mortality in coho. And it seems to be particular to coho salmon. But the rates can be quite impressive. This is a study that they did back, I think, about 2003, 2004, where they compared mortality rates in streams in Seattle with mortality rate in a forested system, Fortson Creek, which is up in the Skykomish drainage, I think. But you can see the rate of adult mortality in Fortson Creek that year was less than 1%. Contrast, mortality rates in streams in Seattle ranged from about 24% for Fauntleroy Creek up to 85, 86% for Thornton Creek. 86% of the adult salmon were dying before they had a chance to spawn. So if you couple the effects associated with altered hydrology, various kinds of changes in the trophic structure, the food web of stream systems, with the fact that coho salmon, in many cases, don't even get a chance to spawn because they're dying of toxicity before they have a chance, you can see why we saw that very strong response in distribution of coho salmon with urbanization that I talked about in our data set. Okay. Which leads us to the question, what's the future of coho salmon or anadromous fish in general in the Puget Sound region, given the fact that we are a very rapidly developing area, at least were until about a year and a half ago. We took a look at the land use designations, essentially the zoning designations for the four major basins where we did this study, Lake Washington north of the Skagit. And at first blush, things look pretty good because fully 70% of the total area in those four basins is zoned or designated in some way as forest. It's private land zoned for forest use. It's federal or state lands that will be maintained in forest. 70%. But you get a much different and much scarier picture if you look only at those portions of those basins that are accessible to anadromous fish, downstream from waterfalls, downstream from barriers. If you look only at the portion of the landscape that salmon and steelhead can use, only 35% of it actually is designated for forest land use. Fully 65% is designated already for some kind of development. And given the way the population has increased in the central Puget Sound region over the last 40 years, I think we can fully expect that development will continue on those forest lands. We went from about 1.6 million people in King, Snohomish, and Skagit County in 1980 to about 2.6 million today, projected to go to about 3 million by 2025, or about a doubling in population in the region over the last 45 years. And consequent with that increase in population is conversion of forest lands to other land uses. This is a report that was developed here at the College of Forest Resources for the Department of Natural Resources a few years back. And I forget what the exact time period they looked at, but I think it was basically the 1980s to about 2003, 2004. And they found that during that time period, across all of Washington State, privately owned forest land was being converted to other land uses at a rate of about 0.37% per year, about 25,000 acres per year. Very high rate. And a lot of that conversion was occurring in the central Puget Sound counties. You can take a look there, King County, the black representing area that was converted from forest to urban development over that time period. And that's in spite of the fact that King County arguably has the most stringent regulations governing land conversion of all the counties in the state. but still we see very rapid conversion. So we're going to continue to see land conversion, which brings up the question, is there any way that we can reasonably expect to maintain naturally spawning populations of salmon in a rapidly urbanizing region like Puget Sound? And based on most of the data we have to hand about urbanization and effects on anadromous fishes, the answer probably is not very much hope. I mean, clearly we can hope for some major technological breakthrough that will allow us to build to our heart's content and still maintain very productive aquatic ecosystems, but I don't see anything on the horizon that's going to allow us to do that. That being the case, then, I think we can expect as we develop that we're going to continue to see populations of anadromous fish switch away from areas where there's more intense human land use and progressively become concentrated in these locations where land uses are less intensive. Well, is there any option for making both development and salmon compatible? And I think there may well be, although it would require a fundamental change in the way we approach land use management in the state. But one thing that we observed in our data set for those 84 index sites where we collected data was that the fish were not equally distributed across those 84 sites. There were sites, and this again shows the proportion of the spawning population at those 84 sites supported by each site. It's the average by year with a standard error shown here. There are some that consistently, year in and year out, supported a very high proportion of the total spawning aggregation. There were others down at this end that year in and year out supported relatively few fish. If you had the capability of identifying and specifically protecting those locations that were responsible for supporting very high levels of productivity, then I think you would have a shot at allowing or maintaining fish, salmon, within an rapidly urbanizing environment. There are some issues associated with this, clearly. The first is that we don't know where those highly productive sites are comprehensively. I've got data for 84 stream reaches across Puget Sound. There are tens of thousands of stream reaches within those four basins. And there isn't sufficient fish data to use fish data alone as a way to identify where the highly productive locations are. But there are some opportunities for doing that using remotely sensed data. I'll talk about that in just a second. Once you've identified these sites, though, you're going to have to protect them from human impact or ensure that the land uses that occur within those locations are compatible with maintaining the long-term productive potential of those sites. Now, there's a flip side to this coin. This is a flip side some folks don't like. And that is, if you're going to identify and protect some sites, that means you're going to direct future development to sites that don't have high productive potential. So development's going to occur. It's not going to go away. But ideally, if you're interested in protecting salmon, directing it towards those areas that have low potential to produce large populations of salmon, or directing it to areas that are already compromised as a result of human land use. So I'm suggesting that you direct development to these kinds of sites. There have to be changes, as I said, in the way we manage land use. I would suggest that we need to incorporate salmon use of the landscape into land use planning in the way that we right now incorporate things like utilities, transportation systems. The distribution of salmon also should go into that. It should influence the way that we make decisions about future land use. That's going to require a fundamentally different approach to zoning than the one we use now. It's a system that's going to have to be more targeted. It's going to have to be more flexible. But another way that I think there may be some opportunity to slow the rate of conversion is increasing the value of forest land. And I'll talk a little bit about these two items, and then I will wrap up. Identifying high productivity sites. As I said, we don't have enough fish data to do this using just information on fish abundance. But there's been a number of tools that have been developed over the last decade, most of them based on digital elevation models, that is, remotely sensed elevation data, or elevation data that's been GIS elevation data layers that have been generated using USGS maps. This is some information that was developed by a Forest Service researcher, Kelly Burnett. And she developed a system and applied it to the north and central Oregon coast, where she used just two relatively simple topographic features to identify sites that would have a high potential to support coho salmon. And those were stream gradient and valley form. And they had made the observation that high coho salmon populations were associated with stream reaches that had relatively low gradient, less than about 2%, and were draining unconstrained valleys. That is, valleys where the stream channel moved back and forth, eroding across that valley bottom, had very well-defined floodplains. She used just a basic 10-meter digital elevation model to identify on a coastwide basis where stream segments were that possessed those characteristics. Here's a close-up for the Tillamook and the Nestucca River drainages. You'll notice one thing. It's very comparable to what we saw at Puget Sound. That is, most of the good sites for coho salmon are located close to saltwater, the lower ends of these watersheds. That also happens to be the area on the Oregon coast where most of the agricultural development has occurred. So again, coho salmon and human land use overlap almost completely. But this kind of a system would give you a starting point to identify those sites that have the correct set of physical characteristics to support high levels of salmon production. It would give you some basis to begin to consider distribution of salmon populations in various kinds of zoning schemes. Increasing forest land value. And here I'm not talking about increasing the value of a 2x4. What I'm talking about is what I've called here non-traditional products. But many of them fall into a category of products that are now being called ecosystem services. There are things like carbon sequestration. Can somebody be paid for sequestering carbon on their land? It's high probability that that will become a viable market. Are there other ecosystem service markets that could be developed over time? Can a landowner be compensated if he maintains very high quality water? Can he be compensated if he maintains certain aspects of wildlife habitat on his ownership? Whether or not those markets will develop remains a question, but if they did, it would increase the value of forest land to the forest landowner and potentially decrease his desire, if you will, to convert that land to another land use. It would have the effect potentially of retaining more forest land as forest. The financial return on some of these ecosystem services is entirely unclear. I mean, the markets haven't been developed. But if it's sufficient, it could have a positive effect. Now, one other non-traditional revenue stream that's being very heavily investigated from forest lands in the Northwest, in the Southeast, in the Southern Hemisphere right now is collecting biomass for energy production. And that's either biomass that's collected and burned in boilers to generate electricity, or there also are some more exotic investigative kinds of research efforts going on where they're trying to take forest biomass and actually produce transportation fuels, liquid fuels, replacement for gasoline from forest biomass. This potentially could represent a very significant increase in value for folks who own forest land. But this is an example of what some of the harvest practices are right now. This is a thing called a biobaler. And the way this works is after somebody harvests a forest setting, removes all of the logs that could be used for lumber, this machine comes back through, it picks up all the tops, all the slash, makes them into big bales, which they set out there in the harvested area, allow to dry for a period of time. A truck comes out, picks those up, takes them to a power mill where they're burned to generate electricity. Now, this is going to generate extra income for the forest landowner. It also has a whole slew of potential environmental issues associated with this change in forest land management. There are some folks who are beginning to put studies on the ground to try to understand what this means. But it's essentially a constant employment or employment security for those of us who do research on forest practices and environmental impacts. So one final note here, it has to do with how we spend our stream restoration dollars. And this is a particularly fond soapbox of mine. We, over the years, have spent a ton of money attempting to, quote-unquote, restore streams in urban environments. I don't think right now, with what we understand about how streams operate and the effect that urbanization has on them, I don't think now there's virtually anything that we can do to urban streams that will make them productive for salmon, that will enable them to support for the long-term naturally reproducing populations of Pacific salmon. My suggestion is that we take those monies that would be directed towards urban systems and spend that money in areas where we have, one, the correct set of physical characteristics to suggest that when that site is restored, it can support high levels of salmon production, and two, where we have some assurance that the land uses that will occur near that stream reach over the long term will remain compatible with maintaining high productive stream habitat conditions. So I think in terms of both how we direct future development and how we direct our restoration resources, there's the possibility for us to do something here that would increase the chances of retaining salmon in the Puget Sound region. But we really have to change the way that we're approaching this issue from what we've done over the last several decades. And that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, Bob, a lot of the urban streams are also places where there's been a lot of very intense harvest and hatchery management practices. So not only is the habitat worse, but the fish may have a great exhibit potential. Were you able to look at that across the Skagit? Because like Lake Washington is one of those systems that is also both highly urbanized. When you look historically at the harvest rates and also the hatchery rates, they've had probably the most intense fishery management actions of any system.
Yeah, they have. That's a good point, Gino. We tried to tease that out. The first way we tried to tease that out was by talking to the guys running the survey program, and they said, oh no, we picked these sites and we're looking at wild fish. And I said, oh yeah, I bet. But surprisingly, once we went to add marks on the hatchery releases for the mark selective fisheries, they went back out and they found out that, in fact, most of these sites did not have much hatchery straying into them. So they at least, for the most part, I think, did represent, if not wild, at least naturally spawning populations. So that didn't turn out to be as big a problem as I feared it was going to be when we got into this. Yet the question was, how much effort, time, money would it take to actually collect the information that we would need to incorporate salmon use across the landscape into our zoning approach? And my guess is that we could probably do it pretty quickly. I mean, it would be, as a matter of fact, that Kelly Burnett method of looking at channel configuration and how it's distributed across the landscape is something that I'm involved in right now for King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap counties. I'm involved in a research effort with Marina Alberti and Nate Mantua and Dan Miller looking at distribution of these high potential habitats across those four counties. That can be done very quickly, and that represents a starting point. You could then ground truth those sites to determine whether or not what you're seeing from remotely sensed digital data actually corresponds to what's on the ground. The trickier part is actually the policy and the political will to incorporate that component into land use planning. I think that would be the hard thing to do. Certainly would be a lot of resistance to adding another layer of restrictions over what we can do where. It was a question about ecosystem services, which essentially is compensation to people for behaving in particular ways on their land that protects resource values that we own in common, wildlife, fisheries, water quality. And I think you'll see the carbon market. And this is the key. There has to be some way to monetize those values. I think you'll see the carbon market become much more active over the next 5 to 7 years. I mean, there's lots of movement underway to compensate people for carbon sequestration as a result of climate change. There are also schemes underway to create comparable markets for things like wildlife habitat, even for water. But whether or not those things actually come about is completely unknown at this point. I mean, there's a huge amount of literature out there and all kinds of research activity going on around ecosystem management. There's all kinds of economists and people who aren't economists but are behaving like economists right now to try and figure out how we can actually tap into this as a way to augment our traditional regulatory approach and get people to behave better on their lands. So I don't know whether it'll come about. I suspect the carbon market will. Weyerhaeuser's actively involved in the development of that carbon market and the rules that are going to govern it. But we're not actively involved in any of these other issues. Yeah, that's a great question. Essentially, and let me repeat it. The question was, if you specifically protect those areas that have high salmon abundance and basically write off those areas of lower abundance, what effect are you having on the genetic makeup of the population? And that's an excellent question. I don't have an answer for it. Now, my hope would be that we would protect a lot of these highly productive sites in order to maintain population abundance, but that there would still be a fairly substantial proportion of the low productivity sites that would be protected. Certainly in the four basins where we did this analysis, there are lower productivity sites on Forest Service ground that would remain, presumably would remain in pretty good condition. State lands also have some of those lower productivity sites. So I would hope that at least a proportion of those lower productivity subpopulations would be maintained across the landscape as well. But without the high productivity populations, I think you run a chance of the entire thing winking out. Again, that's an excellent question. The question was, okay, I've essentially laid out a scheme here for protecting coho salmon. It wasn't even salmon. It was just coho. What about other species that have different habitat requirements? Aren't they likely to be distributed differently across the landscape And if we develop a comprehensive system that protects all of them, aren't we just going to lock up everything? And the answer to that is I don't think so. There are different habitat requirements even across the salmon. Steelhead utilize different habitat than coho. Chinook utilize different habitat than coho. But my view there is that with steelhead, a lot of the use there is at higher elevations. They use steeper stream channels. Some of that will come with the protected public lands. But you could clearly develop a similar kind of an analysis system which identified the high productivity steelhead sites as well. Chinook salmon primarily are critters of big rivers. And regardless of what you do in these headwater systems, if you don't protect the big rivers and protect the floodplains along the big rivers, maintain them as a viable component in the overall aquatic landscape, you're going to lose everything anyway. So they also have to be protected. And I didn't talk about the connectivity of this whole issue. The main river systems, the estuaries, all have to be maintained in high condition if you're going to have any hope of retaining salmon. But I think that it's not every place, everywhere has to be protected for all time. I think what you can do is develop a system that retains all the components that's necessary for supporting healthy aquatic habitats across the region. And then, again, direct development pressures into locations where the ecological values are less. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Bob.